Killer Innovations Podcast for Monday, June 6, 2005, show number 13, brought to you from Washington, D.C. Hello, and welcome to the podcast. The opinions expressed in this podcast are mine and mine alone, and do not necessarily reflect those of my past, current, or future employers. Sorry about the podcast being going up a day late. Kind of a crazy weekend here in Washington, D.C. It's one of the few weeks that I'm actually home the entire week. Not to mention the fact that my oldest daughter is now engaged to be married, and the party was at our house for the engagement party. So I'm still recovering. It's Monday morning here in D.C., and I'm still trying to get over the fact that I am feeling much older than I did just a couple of weeks ago with now with this engagement. As I said, I'm here in Washington, D.C., getting ready to head out. I will be speaking both Tuesday and Wednesday this week at SuperCom in Chicago. So if any of you are going to be there, please feel free to stop by on Tuesday. Drop me an email so that we can coordinate schedules and maybe get together for a quick chat or maybe even a drink. Also, I'm in the process of changing the website for the Killer Innovations blog. So I'll let you know when those changes have been made. So right now, the only real changes that are going to be made to the blog will be the show notes. I'll be focusing all of the effort onto the design of the new site. I'll let you know. And actually, I may let some of you know a little bit early, those of you who listen to the podcast, to give you a URL to go take a look at some design options and give us some feedback. I'm also looking to add kind of a community space where those listeners of the podcast can get together and exchange their own tricks and experiences around innovation and creativity, and just kind of create a community area where we can all exchange ideas and potentially seek out help and assistance from other listeners. So I'll also keep you up to date on that. In today's podcast, we're going to cover the normal three segments. The first, I'm going to expand upon discussion around scenario planning. I think it was back on show number 9. Where I talked about scenario planning as one of the tools of innovation. Got a lot of feedback on that show, and so I thought I'd expand it, and we'll actually take segment one and expand upon scenario planning and give you some, I wouldn't call them killer questions, but what I call is questions to ponder when I'm thinking about scenario planning or when I'm putting together strategic planning activities. Second, in the weak signals, I'm going to talk about gaming. For those of you who are regular listeners know that I just came off of a 2.5 week whirlwind tour of Southeast Asia and spent a lot of time looking in the gaming market as really as an opportunity for some explosive growth in the marketplace. So segment two, weak signals, we're going to talk about gaming. And then, of course, in segment three, we are going to have the killer question of the week. So let's go ahead and just jump right in and talk about scenario planning. In show number 9, I talked about Peter Schwartz, who used to be with Royal Dutch Shell as head of their strategic planning organization back in the 60s and 70s. And Schwartz and actually his predecessors and his team there at Royal Dutch Shell had adopted kind of a pretty creative kind of strategic planning activity. So I kind of want to take a step back and look back at what was happening back in the 60s and 70s. I mean, as a kid, I can still remember 1973, the U.S. found itself in a crisis. Basically, the oil embargo was in place. You know, we saw gas prices jump upwards of 300% overnight. The economic and the political turmoil was quite evident. I remember the laws where if your license plate ended in an even number, you had you got to buy gas on even days of the month. If your license plate number was odd, you got to buy gas on the odds days of the month. and you people waiting in 5, 6, 7 hours to get gas. During the time, many firms, including the oil companies, were on the verge of collapse. Oil being an input for a lot of products, plastics, rubber, etc. Fuel being used to make electricity, power the steel mills. Yet during the time, one company, Royal Dutch Shell, thrived. Why? Why did they thrive and the others struggle? While the other businesses all panicked, Royal Dutch Shell executed a plan that they had previously rehearsed should a crisis or an opportunity reveal itself in its plans. The plan was based on one of many possible futures that Shell considered during its regular planning process. In this case, Shell recognized that it couldn't predict the future, so it had actually put together a plan that looked at multiple futures. And this process that Royal Dutch Shell put together became the basis of what we call today scenario planning. Through this planning process, Royal Dutch Shell had foreseen the possible formation of OPEC and the resulting shift of control in the oil supply. Think about it though. In today's terms, albeit we don't have the oil crises, many people would think though otherwise when we have gas prices in the US north of $2, and those of for the European listeners are probably laughing hysterically. They would love to have gas prices at $2 a gallon, but the Americans are quite up in arms about the current oil prices. But in today's terms, we're dealing with our own set of crises, or in some cases, we may refer to that as opportunities, such as terrorism, competitive innovation, corporate scandal, whatever. The question is your company, business, nonprofit, is it thriving or is it panicking? The problem is that executives are being caught by surprise. Strategies and plans that we spend a lot of time working on quickly are being undone by the unexpected changes, whether that's changes in the economy, in innovation, in regulations, whatever it is that defines the playing field that we compete on. And the challenge is that while these executives and the investors and the board of directors are blindsided, the result is they often make sudden and reactionary decisions. Stop all spending, stop all hiring. The problem is that many times these rash, reactionary decisions end up exacerbating the original problem, with the potential risk that it puts the business into a death spiral. The real question is how do you get to the point where you can see what your decision is going to have as far as impact? In many cases, the executives and investors and boards look back and say, oh, if we'd only know what was going to happen, if we only knew what the result of our decision was going to have in the business, we could have avoided the crises. The real challenge is to avoid the turmoil, businesses need a better way to predict the future. So what does the future hold? It is the age-old question that businesses attempt to answer all the time, and we tend to focus on it heavily during the annual strategic planning process. The problem is that many strategies are severely constrained by unpredictable events. You don't know what's going to happen, what's going to change in laws and regulations in your country. You don't know what your competitors are going to do to cause turmoil in your own business. You don't know what's going to happen with, let's say, raw supplies that are critical for you to manufacture your product or service. And the challenge here is that many businesses, we tend to try to focus on the unconscious process of aligning, or I would prefer to say more like aiming, the strategy to a single future. We tend to get comfortable around trying to identify the future, the path to the business, and therefore drive the strategy to that. The problem is that the resulting strategy has built-in blind spots, things that you're not aware of, things that you're not looking at. And the thing is that these blind spots cause us to have some kind of assumptions about things that could happen or things that couldn't happen. We tend to think positively. We think that we tend to think rosy thoughts. But the reality is that mentally, when we focus on a single future, we are ignoring or we're using kind of our what I would call a juicy rationalization that something could never happen. MCI would never declare bankruptcy. Arthur Andersen would never fail as a business. But that in reality is we don't have to look far in the past to see these kinds of sudden changes. Think back to 1999 when we saw the dot-com bust. We saw the telecom industry go through its own turmoil. The reality is that we all have these blind spots in our own strategic planning because, again, we tend to want to focus on this, what we think is the most likely single future, and ignore the kind of what happens on either extreme. And the reality is that businesses and management teams that haven't foreseen these surprise events are at a loss for ways to react when the turmoil happens. The majority of the management teams base their view of the future on an extrapolation of past results. So what do? We look at the past. What did we make last year in revenue? This year's plan is basically revenue with an 8% growth on top of it. Not much as far as deep strategic planning, but that tends to be what happens when we go through the planning exercise. The reality is the future cannot be predicted. I mean, my day-to-day job is part of strategic planning. I had strategy and planning at previous roles. And let's face it, the late 90s, even the early 80s in Silicon Valley, when I was out in Silicon Valley, you get humbled pretty quickly by the fact that you recognize that you cannot predict the future with any kind of certainty. There's an old Arab saying that I like to use that says, "He who predicts the future lies, even if he tells the truth." We try to come off with some kind of authority that we know what the future is going to hold, but in reality, we don't. To better prepare to respond to the market chaos, businesses, management teams, executives, you need to question the assumptions about everything. We all tend to try to put our own thoughts, we bring our own expertise, we bring in the human ability to identify and see patterns. But we also have to recognize that sometimes those patterns and those thinkings put us into ruts. We tend to like to do something because it worked for us in the past. We tend to try to drive a certain direction because that has been successful for us. The key here, though, is that we need to be thinking about multiple futures. You don't know what's going to happen. We don't know what's going to happen with raw materials, regulatory, financial, stock market, competitors. Terrorism, whatever the case might be, you need to realize that we need to plan for multiple futures. The key is the point's not to find the most probable future and bet the company on it. Instead, a business needs to identify a range of possible futures, what we call scenarios, and then once you deeply understand those scenarios, help you to make better strategic decisions. The key here is that once you understand what those multiple possible futures will look like, you'll be able to respond, and the real key here is ultimately influence the future. Assuming you've thought seriously about it, you've thought seriously about what your perfect dream scenario is, what your absolute nightmare scenario is. The nightmare scenario is it's the thing that wakes the CEO up in the middle of the night in a cold sweat. And then what is the most likely scenario? And let's go back to Royal Dutch Shell. The oil embargo happened. They had already predicted that as their nightmare scenario. They had already run through scenario exercises. What if this happens? What should we do as a business? When that happened, when the oil embargo happened, they didn't panic. They simply clicked into that plan that they had already put in place, and they were actually able to leverage it to their advantage and actually thrive during the oil embargo process. And for some reason, even when a business, when we look at multiple futures, there's almost this irresistible temptation to choose one scenario over another. Unfortunately, reality does not follow even the best predictions. We all try to do what we think are the best predictions, but let's face it, reality says that, or I should say, reality is that those predictions never come out exactly as you've planned them. And let's understand, the real purpose of a business going through this scenario exercise is really to help management suspend their disbelief. We need to allow management, yourselves, your planning teams, even your nonprofits, your outside board, you need to allow them to truly believe that almost anything could happen. That even your worst nightmare or even your absolute perfect outcome could happen, and that you need to be able to plan for multiple futures. Then and only then can your teams prepare for what they don't think is going to happen. And just think, what could have been the result for the telecom market had the alternative futures, such as the evaporation of capital, the overbuilding of capacity, the rapid decline in stocks, been identified, rehearsed, and prepared for? Now, the telecom industry is personal to me, and believe me, hindsight is 20/20. So, to take full advantage of scenario planning, you must, one, suspend your belief that something just couldn't happen. And two, open your thinking to all possibilities. So next, I have a series of questions that I think will help drive your thinking when you're going into strategic planning exercises with your teams. First off, sit down and write out what you believe is the perfect future for your business. Your business could be you personally, if you're self-employed, your division, your large enterprise, your not-for-profit. What is the perfect future? Two, what are the five challenges you will face if the perfect future comes to pass? Such as available capital, expertise, international expansion. Three, what would be the indicators that predict your perfect future is about to emerge? Now, this is important. Indicators are key to the scenario planning exercises. These are early flags, early indicators that this particular scenario, this perfect future, is emerging. So, does this include things like venture capital investment into a specific technology space? International stability, meaning reduction of terrorism, stability of the currency market, or industry growth in target emerging areas? So, what are the indicators that predict your perfect future is about to emerge? And these are the things that management then should monitor on a quite regular basis. And when they start seeing these indicators happen, shift the strategy in order to meet that particular scenario. Next, what is the nightmare future for your business? What is the nightmare scenario that absolutely gets you up in the middle of the night and you break out in a cold sweat? And what are the five challenges you'll face if the nightmare scenario comes to pass? The five challenges: collapse of your market value, the availability of your raw materials, decline in sales, loss, turnover in headcount. What are the five challenges you're going to face if the nightmare's future comes to pass? Next is, what would be the indicators that predict your nightmare future is about to emerge? Such as, the futures market for raw materials. So, do you watch the mercantile market in order to see what the futures cost is for the raw materials? Is that oil, corn, gold, lead, whatever it is? In many cases, people think, okay, I don't have a raw material that I should track on the stock market. Well, reality is that many people in the computer industry track the raw goods that go into things like microprocessors, circuit boards, CRTs. They break it down all the way to the raw materials in order to use those as early indicators of price changes in their raw materials or their manufactured goods. What are other indicators for the nightmare future? Track the patent portfolio of your competitors. What's the CHAI index of the patent portfolio of your competitors? If you're not familiar with the CHAI index, you should become familiar with the CHAI index. This is not just the number of patents, but the reference to your patents, meaning the more that your patents are referenced as prior art to other patents, the higher the value your patents have. If you're not familiar with it, go out to the MIT Technology Review site and you can look at the CHAI index for a number of the top companies generating patents. So next, after you've looked at it from your dream scenario to your nightmare scenario, and only after you've done those two, do the same for your most likely future. So do the same thing we just went through for your dream scenario, your nightmare scenario. Do it for your most likely future. So now you have your three scenarios. Now comes the ultimate question. What strategies would you implement that would better prepare you for all three of your futures? And the key here is that you want to find strategies and approaches that will work well in all three. I mean, the ultimate is for you to innovate on strategies that can respond to any three of these scenarios. And those strategies give you the most flexibility, allows you to be the most adaptive, and allows you to respond to the changing influences in the business. Okay, so again, just really quick running through these questions. What is your perfect scenario? Look at the challenges, look at the indicators. What is your nightmare scenario? What are your challenges? What are your indicators? What is your most likely scenario? What does your most likely future look like? What are the challenges? What are its indicators? And then run through the strategies that you're developing for your business, nonprofit, for your small business. What are the strategies and what would you implement that would better prepare you for all of the futures? And hopefully you found that useful. Please give me feedback on that. It's a little bit outside of the typical innovation, creativity, but given the feedback that we got on show number 9, I wanted to expand upon that. Well, we're quickly running out of time, so we're going to quickly go through the next two segments. Next one up is gaming. For those of you who have been listeners to the podcast for some time, know that I just came off of an extended trip in Southeast Asia, spent a lot of time looking at the gaming market. And one of the early weak signals that I've come out of the gaming market in is this whole issue of virtual goods. So you're playing an online game, whether that's Warcraft or a Sony EverQuest, whatever the game is, and you build up both your status and level, and you acquire virtual goods, virtual gold, virtual weapons, whatever the case might be. Well, I don't know how many of you are familiar with the fact that there is an entire market in these virtual goods. You can go on to eBay, you can go on to other sites, and literally people will pay real money to acquire these virtual goods. There are players who literally play full-time on these games to get characters built up with abilities and strengths and powers, and then sell those characters off for real money. Now I thought, okay, this is kind of this underground thing, really not a whole lot going on. But last year, it's estimated that people playing in the gaming market spent $800 million, $800 million, real money, to buy these virtual goods, virtual gold, virtual weapons, virtual characters playing in these game markets. Think about that for a second. What's the impact going to be on society, the legal system? In fact, in Japan, they've had to evoke new laws to grant protection for virtual goods. You're in a game environment A bunch of other game players team up, they attack you, they take away your virtual goods. Well, those virtual goods had real money. They had real value from the standpoint that you've either spent money or there is a market that can be measured and tracked that can attach value. So now the entire legal system has to begin looking at how do I control, how do I have to invoke laws into a virtual world? What happens if you're playing a game and the game crashes? And in the process of crashing, your game provider loses all of the virtual goods. And let's say you had spent a couple thousand dollars on eBay buying gold and weapons, and all of a sudden now they're gone. Who's liable for that? So here's a situation where we see an entirely new, almost, I hate to use the term, parallel universe that's emerging that now is going to cause or could potentially have a huge ripple effect. So what do you think? You know, one of the ideas here is what about a virtual bank? You know, so I buy something in the virtual world, can I buy and post it into a virtual bank? What about virtual insurance? If someone breaks into my virtual home and steals my stuff, can I get virtual insurance to get those items back or to get compensated for the loss in in the gaming world? There's a whole variety, I think, of of emerging opportunities that are going to happen in this space. And a lot of people think, oh, gaming, it's the 12 to 18-year-old males that are doing this. Keep in mind that the total value of the gaming market in calendar year 05 is going to exceed the total worldwide market for DVDs. Think about that. Total market for gaming is going to exceed the total market value for DVDs. So this is not something that's a little niche play. It's a huge market. It's expanding at a phenomenal rate. And here's this week's signal that I think is going to be an indicator of things that are going to emerge in this gaming space quickly. And with that, I think we'll wrap up segment two on the weak signals. And let's go on to segment three, the killer question of the week. So the killer question of the week is really focused around some of the challenges we have in dealing with, or I shouldn't say dealing with, or enabling customers to use a product. And this killer question is what is inconvenient about assembling my product? What is inconvenient about assembling my product? Now, for those of you who have hard good products or who design hard good products, many of you will try to focus in on are the instructions well written? Are they translated into the languages of my customers? The key here, though, is to look at the entire value chain around assembling my product. And the example I want to use is IKEA. Now, IKEA is all over the world. Many of us have the experience of going to an IKEA store. The real innovation at IKEA is not just the fact that they have well-designed products that are fashionable and people want them in their homes, but it's also the way in which they package them, what they call flat packs. IKEA designs and spends a lot of effort in minimizing the total volume needed in order to package down each product that they sell. They optimize the size of those packages to fit into the ocean-going shipping container so they can maximize the amount of product that they can put into each container and therefore minimize the cost to ship each item. But just as important is they've designed it to make it very easy and very convenient for the homeowners to be able to get that goods home, to be able to put it on the roof of your car, stick it in the back of your van, whatever the case might be. And so, you know, again, the innovation here isn't just about, you know, are the directions good? And, you know, and I put together IKEA bookshelves for my daughter, one of my oldest daughter for her first apartment. My middle daughter bought an IKEA desk for in Florida where she goes to school. Putting that together, you know, very easy to do, very easy to follow the instructions. The fact is that they've looked at how do I address the convenience of putting together my product, not just around the actual assembly of the product, but in the entire value chain. How do I make it easier for them to buy, easier to get it to the location, to actually do the assembly, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So again, the killer question this week is, what is inconvenient about assembling my product? And with that, we're just coming up on 30 minutes, so I'm going to wrap up the show for this week. Hopefully next week I'll be able to get back onto the normal schedule and be able to put the podcast out on the weekend. Please, please send feedback, podcast@killerinnovations.com. Visit the killerinnovations.com website. I'll have show notes up there. Particularly on the gaming piece, there's a URL that I'll put up there that points you to this individual who tracks down to unbelievable amount of detail, the leading games, number of users, market share, great, great background information on the whole gaming space that you can use for your own strategies, particularly if you want to look at the weak signals and see if there might be some opportunities for your business or for yourselves in that market. Again, send feedback. Please call the voicemail feedback line, 703-636-4460. If you have a question, pose it on the voicemail line. I'll include it in a future podcast and we'll answer it directly. Also, we are now in the month of June, so voting for your favorite podcast has restarted. And June 1st, everything gets reset back to zero, and you can now re-vote for your favorite podcasts. I would encourage you to vote for your favorite podcast, because again, that is feedback to the people who invest the time and effort to put these podcasts out, that you are getting value from them and that you do enjoy them. So again, go to podcastalley.com and search for your favorite podcast and vote. And with that, I thank you for listening and look for your feedback this week, and we'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.